going on. She's the driver of this particular ship. Major way.
The 19th of September 2017.
And I'll go ahead and call the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary to order as well.
And one of the first things I'd like to do is introduce a new member on the House side. New Representative Andrea Salinas is joining us. I asked her to come up and sit with us today. And welcome.
Howdy.
Thank you.
Name tag, doesn't it?
And also, that's a nice poster. I also would like to welcome back two members that have previously served on Senate Judiciary, Jeff Cruz, as well as Sarah Gelser. So thank you all very much for being willing to be part of our committee, and we'll be moving forward with seven for this coming and future sessions.
So we don't feel quite so outnumbered when we have these joint meetings.
And yet this was a special request because y'all have so many on the House side, we just felt like it was kind of unbalanced, so we're working.
So, Senator, did you have some birthing pains with that? Or?
A little bit.
Okay.
Next item on the agenda is the adoption of interim committee rules.
Me. Chair Barker, I move to adopt the proposed interim committee rules dated September 19, 2017.
Representative Williamson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 19, 2017. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
And we also need to adopt our rules, so I'll take a motion. Senator Thatcher.
Chair Brzezinski, I move to adopt the proposed interim committee rules dated September 19, 2017.
Senator Thatcher moves for the adoption of the proposed committee rules dated September 19, 2017. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Next, we'll open an informational meeting, a report from the Oregon Bar and Futures Task Force. Honorable Chris Garrett and Amber Hollister, please. Good to welcome a former member of our committee, Judge Garrett, up to the other side of the room here.
He looks happy too.
Yeah. Yeah.
He likes that other branch of government.
Yeah, he's better.
No, he misses us. Come on, he misses us.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, and members, thank you for having us here today. I'm Chris Garrett. I'm a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, former representative from House District 38. So congratulations to the new holder of that seat, Representative Salinas. I'm joined today by Amber Hollister, who's the general counsel of the state bar. And we're here to discuss a report recently issued by a task force of the bar and accepted by its board of governors. We were here in December. I don't remember the date, but I remember the day because it was the day it took most of us a few hours to get home in the snow. And we came to talk to you about the work that at that time we were just beginning. And you asked us to come back at the conclusion of that work and report back to you, and we're pleased to be here to do that today. From late 2016 through June of this year, I served as the chair of the regulatory committee of the Bar's Futures Task Force. Ms. Hollister was the principal staff person for our committee. The task force was established because the Bar's Board of Governors recognizes that the market for legal services is undergoing an intense transformation, driven principally by technological innovation. Companies with names like Avvo and LegalZoom and Rocket Lawyer, which didn't exist even when I began practicing less than 20 years ago, are now a part of the market and they are here to stay. The bar also recognizes that the unmet need for legal services is enormous. In fact, it's almost beyond our ability to understand. When I began this work on the task force, I would have guessed that the number of Oregonians dealing with family law or housing disputes without any legal help was significant. But I would never have guessed that it exceeds 80% in those two areas of the law. Clearly, our efforts to fund legal aid and to encourage pro bono services by practicing lawyers, although important, have not been adequate to meet the need. What also came as a surprise to our task force was the number of unrepresented Oregonians who are unrepresented not necessarily because they don't think they can afford a lawyer, although that's true in some cases and might be the reason most of us think of first, but for any number of other reasons. They may not even think of their problem as a legal problem. They may not think a lawyer can help them. They may not have any idea where to start in terms of accessing legal services, or they may choose to represent themselves just because that's what they want to do. Add to that the fact that people today have different expectations for how to locate and engage professional service providers than they did in the past. We expect information to be available at the click of a mouse, and many people think that that should include information about what a particular legal service will cost. Well, that's not how the market for legal services has traditionally operated. In short, we are talking about major disruption on both the supply and the demand sides of the legal services equation. That disruption makes it necessary for a state bar that wants to be true to its mission of protecting the public and furthering access to justice to take a hard look at itself, how it's currently doing things, and whether its existing regulatory framework, which was largely written for a very different time, is adequate to today's needs. In that spirit, the task force met in two different committees in a series of public meetings throughout late 2016 and the first half of this year. On the regulatory side, we formed three work groups and ultimately made recommendations organized around three general topics. First, we recommend licensure of paraprofessionals, paralegals, to provide limited services in two of the highest need areas of the law, landlord-tenant and family law. Here we follow the examples of our neighbor to the north, Washington, and several other jurisdictions in North America and elsewhere that have moved forward with programs like this in order to expand the number of service providers that are available in areas where people's legal needs are often acute but not overly complicated. In the field of medicine, we began to recognize quite some time ago that some services can be provided just as well or better by a nurse practitioner, for example, as by an MD. The law has been slow to come to grips with this, but the reality is that not every legal problem requires a solution by a person with a law degree. A well-trained and experienced paralegal can do some legal tasks better and more efficiently than a brand new lawyer. The second area is revisions to the rules of professional conduct, the internal rules regulating the practice, to remove potential barriers to innovation by those new companies, like the ones I mentioned earlier, that have the potential to help thousands of Oregonians access legal services. Our recommendations, which have been adopted by the Bar's Board of Governors, leave intact the core principles and rules aimed at protecting consumers while relaxing some specific prohibitions on advertising and sharing fees. And when I'm finished with my remarks, I'm going to ask Ms. Hollister to say more about what specifically those proposed changes are. The third area is recognizing that no matter what we do to make legal services more readily available, some people will choose to be self-represented. So the third area of our recommendations involves doing more to help what we term these self-navigators, people who are getting themselves through the court system. And these recommendations include improving and systematizing the availability of online forms, do-it-yourself forms, making self-help centers available in county courthouses, and making some modest changes to family law and small claims proceedings. I was pleased to be part of this effort, which included representatives from different sectors of the legal services industry, members of the public, representatives of the three Oregon law schools, the courts, and others. As noted, the task force report has been accepted by the Bar's Board of Governors. Specific recommendations will be before the Bar's House of Delegates at its November meeting. Our purpose here today is to make you aware of the work that we've done to date, as you requested, and we're happy to try to answer any questions that you may have. And now, before turning to questions, I'd like to just ask Ms. Hollister to say a little bit more about the two specific changes we propose to the rules of professional conduct.
Thank you, Judge. Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Amber Hollister, General Counsel for the Oregon State Bar. What I do every day is provide ethics advice to lawyers, and so I'm comfortable talking about the rules of professional conduct. And those are the rules that govern attorneys' conduct to ensure that they're not engaging in the bad stuff. So I answer questions about those black letter rules all the time. They're rules that are promulgated by the Oregon Supreme Court. So as part of this committee's work, we're recommending specific modest changes to a few of the rules. The first change has to do with in-person solicitation and advertising. Right now, there is an across-the-board bar on in-person solicitation or real-time electronic contact, think chatting, with prospective clients, unless you have a prior professional or social relationship with the individual or they're a lawyer. So essentially, the rules create a barrier of sorts between lawyers who want to approach prospective clients and talk with them about what their legal needs might be. And what we found when we looked at this issue is that was a barrier to access to justice, because studies show that many ordinary folks don't recognize when they have a legal issue. And so enabling lawyers to have frank and open conversations with members of the public about what their legal needs might be actually helps to get them into the system and allow them to seek remedies that are available. And so what we're recommending is a change to Rule of Professional Conduct 7.3 that would focus the rule on consumer protection to enable lawyers to talk with consumers but protect the most vulnerable individuals from coercion or who may be subject to duress. And so I think that's an important shift, and it's in line with Oregon's robust free speech protections. So that's on the in-person advertising side. The other significant change has to do with lawyer referral services. Now, the Oregon State Bar operates a lawyer referral service, and in your materials, you'll see there's a description of that service. It's very popular. Basically, people can call the bar, they can ask a referral, and for a flat fee, they can consult with an attorney in their geographic area about their legal issue. And that's a very workable system. But what we found is oftentimes consumers go online and start searching for legal help right out of the gate. So it's not uncommon now for us to turn to an app to solve all our problems. So whether you're looking at Uber or Lyft, for instance, or you're putting your house up online for sale, we look to the internet as a way to overcome difficulty. And Oregonians are doing that. And they're doing that today by using online services that enable them to connect with lawyers for fixed fees. So under our current rules of professional conduct, specifically Rule 5.4 and 7.2, there are some prohibitions that prohibit lawyers from engaging with online lawyer referral services in instances where they may be asked to share a legal fee with those online providers. So the names that Judge Garrett mentioned earlier, the Avos, the LegalZoom, the Rocket Lawyers, to some degree or another, they employ that model. And there are some significant questions about whether our members can engage and participate in those services, those market services. And what our proposed rule would do is create more flexibility so that our members can engage with the public online and utilize those services, but we seek to still protect the ordinary folks who are looking for legal services by ensuring transparency, by requiring disclosure about fee sharing, the amount and manner of fee sharing in the rule itself, and also to require that lawyers to cap fees so that they can't charge a clearly excessive fee when that's viewed in combination with the lawyer referral fee. We're looking for the Oregon way here. We're looking for a way forward that honors the consumer and puts their needs first and allows lawyers to innovate, because we do see a lot of opportunity with respect to legal technology. So in a nutshell, those are the changes.
And that concludes what we wanted to talk about with you, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Representative Bile?
I read the report, and I really appreciate the work that's gone into it. It's clearly a very thoughtful treatment of the issue. I'm wondering if the trial courts have weighed in much on this concept, particularly of the sort of forms-driven nature of getting through those, what I think, Judge Garrett, you called simpler practices, which we all know aren't all that simple in reality.
Well, Chairs Barker and Prusansky and Representative Bile, Yes, they have. And a lot of what we are proposing in the report builds on some work that's already begun in some of our larger courts and some of our rural courts. And Multnomah County has been actively working on some proposals for making more self-help resources available, and they're patterning their recommendations on some things that have been done in other places, including Los Angeles and very high-volume courts. And I think we have some more outlying courts in rural areas that have done the same, but maybe Ms. Hollister can refresh me on that.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, and Representative Vial. So you make an excellent point. We are very interested in partnering with the judicial system to improve the availability of online forms. And as you're probably aware, the Oregon Judicial Department is already working hard on its iForms. And the bar is seeking to support that work and partner with the judicial department. I think that there is still a lot of room for progress in that area. And one of the things that we're doing as a result of this committee is we're opening direct lines of communication between legal aid, the Oregon Judicial Department, and the Oregon State Bar, because between the three of those entities, we really have the best resources on the market in Oregon for self-navigators. And so we're looking to streamline those and, as Judge Garrett said, systematize them so that it's easier for just a person who's a little bit lost to find their way.
Follow up. And what's our sense of what legislative activity really needs to take place around this and what kind of timing that might take?
Chairs Barker and Przanski, Representative Vial, the recommendations that are made in our report do not require any statutory change. There may be an interest in making a statutory change if, as we change the bar's regulatory structure to enhance the ability of online service providers and forms providers to do business and clarify their right to do business in the state, there may be an interest or a need for a statutory change to address some consumer protection issues that may arise in that context, but that's not directly implicated by our report or proposed.
So the unauthorized practice questions still would rest with the lawyers themselves or the bar itself to be determined to do.
Chairs Barker, Przanski, and Representative, yes, it would. And furthermore, our proposed regulatory changes also would leave intact the statutes that, as you know, exist that regulate, for example, and prohibit in-person advertising in certain types of cases and in certain venues. Obviously, our proposals don't reach those statutes at all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Williamson.
So I have a comment and a question to Representative Vial. I think one of the ways that we will see this conversation manifest itself here is in budget conversations. I know for the Multnomah County Courthouse, we had long and in-depth conversations about what the needs are for non-representative litigants in the courthouse itself. So the computer systems, the access to terminals, things like that will look a lot different in the new Multnomah County Courthouse because so many folks are coming in without representation, especially in family law.
Strikes me that could go both ways too eventually.
Yeah.
That we could actually be saving some judicial resources in the long run.
That's right, because what's happening is unrepresented folks are showing up in court and essentially asking judges for legal advice, right? And so it's difficult for our judges to navigate often. And so I think we'll see it in requests around upgrading and rebuilding courthouses. We'll see a different kind of infrastructure request than we've seen in the past. So that's some of how it will show up here. My question to I guess Judge Garrett is, did you talk at all about the bill we passed in 2016 around notarios and how that kind of legal service becomes an issue when you talk about paraprofessionals, since we did expand the crime, a criminal statute around notarios?
Chairs Barker, Przanski, Representative Williamson, we did. Most of that dialogue took place in one of our committee's work groups that Ms. Hollister is more acquainted with, so I'm going to defer to her on the answer to that question.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Prozanski, and Vice Chair Williamson. The notarial fraud bill, I know you were definitely a leader on that. The bar stands behind the efforts to prevent notarial fraud, which is essentially where immigration providers sell services they're not able to provide and victimize folks who are actually trying to do the right thing and access the system. So in this effort, we talked about paraprofessional licensing, but the conversation was not to allow that in the immigration arena, in part because of those concerns. So the conversation was to really limit it to family law and landlord-tenant, in part acknowledging the complexities of immigration law. That said, I think on the self-navigation side, there is work to be done to provide resources to individuals who are seeking to apply for access to the system. So,
thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. You mentioned that the regulatory piece was one piece of the task force. Will we be hearing from the other piece of the task force as well?
Chairs and Representative Greenlee, not today, but there is another component of the task force, what we call the Innovations Committee, and they issued their own report with a variety of recommendations aimed really at practitioners themselves, large and small firms, about how the practice needs to evolve and innovate to deal with the new reality. And I'm afraid I'm just not well equipped to speak to you about that, but maybe in a future meeting, if the committee's interested, there'd be an opportunity to bring the chair of that half of the task force in.
Or Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. I was trying to ascertain exactly what the Futures Committee is. I guess it's looking forward at potential changes to policy within the bar. Is that correct? So that would include pretty much every aspect, but just looking forward to the future, correct?
Chairs and Representative Senator Thatcher, sorry. Yes, the bar is the law is a heavily regulated but largely self-regulated profession. And the work of this task force that I've been involved with has been aimed at taking a close look at what the bar as a self-regulatory body needs to do to bring its regulations as maybe needed up to date to deal with technological change. That's the gist of what our report is about, not just technology, but also recognizing that there's a need that can be met by other types of providers, not just by lawyers.
Right. Thank you. I'm wondering if, and I'm just bringing this up, it's not part of your report, but it has to do with constituents, and I'm getting, more than what seems like a fair share of people complaining about how the PLF operates, the Professional Liability mm-hmm. Fund, and how, perhaps they're, I don't know, put that on your agenda to look at or something. Maybe we can talk offline, but there are some complaints being brought to my attention that make me feel like maybe there needs to be another look at how that's administered, how that all works out, because,
Chairs and About Senator it. Thatcher, that the PLF is a very big topic within the bar that was outside the scope of this report, so I don't have anything to help you with there, but
I was hoping maybe that could be a topic for discussion, or at least pitching it out there as a potential topic to go into, delve into, look at, see how other states do it. Maybe we're the best one out there. I don't know.
Chair Senator Thatcher, what's unique about Oregon is Oregon is the only state in the union that requires mandatory malpractice insurance for attorneys. So for the vast majority of states, there's maybe no relief for clients who are harmed by lawyer malpractice. I can certainly also mention the bar's Client Security Fund, which is a fund of grace, we call it. Essentially, it's there to step up and protect clients in cases of lawyers who engage in dishonest conduct, including theft. So that's another way we protect clients. But maybe we could follow up on your questions about the PLF at a later date.
Thank you.
No.
Okay. One more. Representative Isle again, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, just one follow-up on that, Senator Thatcher. I agree that the issues around insurance to cover claims on these kind of unusual or new forms of representation might be something that is worth looking at, because if you've got AVO or Legal Rocket handing out forms and it turns out there's a bad form that gets through the system, the PLF isn't really going to take care of that.
Chairs and Representative Vile, true. And it's worth noting that in our recommendations regarding paraprofessional licensure, we specifically recommend that those new providers be required to carry liability insurance just as lawyers do. And in preliminary conversations with PLF, PLF has been receptive to the idea of being the carrier for those providers.
Okay, thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I should have made this announcement, but I know some of the attorneys in the room may be leaving after this presentation. I did want to let everyone know that the State Bar is going to be having a CLE tomorrow on elder abuse. It's going to be here in the Capitol Hearing Room C. So those individuals who are interested in elder abuse and have mandatory reporting requirements, you can get that hour tomorrow, noon to 1, here in the building.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay. Next, we'll move on to informational meeting. An update on the Equifax data breach. Aaron Knott, TK Keene, Brian Fordham, please.
All right. How are we going to do this in terms of.
Okay.
We have one
intro. Okay.
Okay. There we go. Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director at the Oregon Department of Justice and for the Attorney General. I'm here to provide this committee with an update on Oregon's response to the Equifax data breach. A little over a week ago, Equifax, which is a credit reporting agency that, along with Experian and TransUnion, received the call every time you want to open a credit card account, every time you want to take out a home loan, or in any other way do anything that requires a credit check, announced a data breach. And when I tell you that this breach affected 143 million Americans, that is not the largest data breach in our country's history. It is, however, by most metrics, the most serious. The reason that this data breach is so serious is because of the nature of the information that is given over to these credit reporting agencies. Because they issue your credit cards, because they issue your home loans, they have information on file that is simply not given to most databases or data agencies. This includes your name, your social security number, your birth date, your addresses, your credit card and financial information, and in many cases, even your driver's license numbers. These are unfortunately, the very data points that a hacker could subsequently use to impersonate you, open financial accounts in your name, and otherwise commit identity fraud against you. So as you can see from the slide, 1,721,725 Oregonians are estimated to be impacted. I say look to the person to your right, look to the person to your left, and probably you know, at least half, if not more, of you have been impacted by this. This is an incredibly significant breach. Now, part of what makes this unusual is with most breaches, you make a deliberate decision to have a business relationship with the entity that houses your data. You say, I'm signing up for a service. I'm signing up for email. I'm signing up for a credit card account. I'm doing business with a retailer. And in exchange for that service, I am making the conscious decision to turn over my data. Equifax is different. They receive information not necessarily from you, but from the lenders, from the retailers, and from the other entities that are interested in your credit, meaning the decision to turn over that information was not actually made by you. Nonetheless, they are in possession of that information. Unless you've stayed off-grid to a degree I think no one here has, there is a very good chance that you are that your information is in the hands of these entities. So to tell you a little bit about the chronology of the data breach itself, what has come to light in the fairly short amount of time since this breach, and we are still gathering information. March 8th, researchers identify a flaw in the security at Equifax. May 13th, Equifax becomes aware of suspicious activity, perhaps exploiting that vulnerability on their servers. May 13th, the hackers enter. July 29th, they become aware of it and shut it down. August 2nd, they bring in cyber investigators who analyze the scope of the breach. 22nd, they register a new domain name, Equifax Security 2017, which is part of their outreach now in managing the breach. And then shortly after that, they announce the breach to the public on September 7th. The period of the breach that went undetected was over 2 months. So, we'll get a little bit, I'll turn this over to Cheryl Heemstra, who knows a lot more about privacy law than I do momentarily, but before I do, we're still in the very early phases of gathering information about this breach, not just who's affected, but what steps were taken to protect the data in the first place, which will be relevant to a subsequent legal inquiry. Our goal today is to help your constituents, who I know are calling you, and let them know what their options are, but also to provide you with the assurance that the Department of Justice is investigating all available legal options in Oregon's response to this case. And because that is an open investigation, as most people here know, the Department of Justice can't talk about those very much, but I do want to provide you the assurance that we are looking into it, and as it becomes available, we will be back to provide you with updates. So with that, I'll turn it over to Cheryl Heemstra to talk about what your constituents can do.
Aaron, Cheryl, maybe either one of you can answer this question. I'm looking at your timeline that you've given us on this whole thing, and wow, I mean, that's a ton full of time. And then, the close at the end, it was over 2 months before they finally notified everybody of what was going on. Why so long? I mean, why did this take so long? And, I mean, what do lenders do then for not receiving any notification at all in the process to try to do any protection?
Chairs and Representative Olson, I think those questions are being asked in every state in the union right now. And I can tell you that what often happens in these cases is a coordinated multi-state investigation and response. But you're asked, those are the questions. We do not yet have the answers.
I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Should we be doing something actively right now then to create a policy that in fact ensures that notification does occur in a timely manner?
Again, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, Representative Olson, I think we'll have a little bit more on the interaction with Oregon legal requirements and this breach from Cheryl in a moment.
Right. Okay, thanks.
Chair Barker, Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director for the Attorney General. So yes, we are looking into it. A little bit about the Equifax response, and then we'll get to Oregon law. Equifax has set up a system to respond to the many, many complaints they are getting. It's a little bit troubled, however. I do want to kind of get that message along to you so you can get that along to your constituents. Equifax is offering a one-year subscription to a credit monitoring service, ironically enough, right? And this service is called Trusted ID Premier. It's important to get that specific language out to your constituents. Often, unfortunately, what happens in some of these instances is these credit reporting agencies or credit monitoring services will try to upsell constituents. Basically, the silver version is free, but then they get sold on the gold or platinum version, right? So something to watch out for. Thankfully, the Attorney General have extracted a promise from them not to collect the credit card number of anybody who's signing up for their free service. This will prevent the, sometimes what happens is the auto-renewal can happen with these. So thankfully, they're not doing that here. But something to watch out for. Equifax itself is waiving credit freeze fees. So we'll get into this in a minute. But in order to freeze your credit in Oregon, it does cost $10 or up to $10 per credit reporting agency. And Equifax is waiving that until November 21st. Again, just kind of a caution for your constituents. This does not mean after the 21st of November they will waive any fees to unfreeze your credit, which also costs $10. So just be aware of that. They've set up a hotline for this, but we've been getting a lot of complaints about clogged phone lines. At one point, their website had, I think this was last week, Thursday, I checked it, please come back on Tuesday when we can handle the volume, right? They're under deluge, and they're, you know, I think moving as fast as they can, but something to watch out for. If constituents do have an issue, please do have them contact us. We are collecting the complaints, and we'll have a person at Equifax we can send them over to. We did issue a scam alert, and I'll get that up on OLIS. We just updated it today. It's in English and in Spanish. A couple things from the breach at the beginning. They did have clause in their agreement when you signed up for this free credit monitoring that you signed up for mandatory arbitration, basically waiving your legal rights to sue them. Again, the Attorney General pushed back on that, and they've removed that language going forward and retroactively. One last thing about their website. They do have this little tool that you can stick in the last six of your Social Security number and your last name, and it's supposed to pop out whether or not your information has been breached. However, there's been some bugs. People have been putting in fake information, and then it says they've been breached. People have been putting in the same information on their phone and on their computer and get different results. Okay. So it's just not reliable, unfortunately. So just things to watch out for there. So for the consumer, these are steps they can take. Probably the best thing you can do is to freeze your credit. But like I said, that's $10. Equifax is waiving that, but not TransUnion or Experian, as far as we know at this point. So something to consider. Also, I'd really recommend the FTC tool, identitytheft.gov. They've already updated their website. It's a kind of a step-by-step response, what consumers can do. And they've already got a button for the Equifax breach with a lot of good information on that. So I'd really recommend the FTC tool. And then there's just more there on the slide for your constituents. Also, just have people check their credit. You can get the free credit report, annualcreditreport.com. If you go online and do free credit report, you're going to get a lot of companies that will charge you for it, but you can get it for free. So it's important to go to that specific website or call that number. So existing Oregon law, what can we do here? Thankfully, from both your committees, we have a data breach law in place since 2007. It says that breached entities must notify consumers. They can do this either by media notice or individual notice. The compromise in the law was, I think it was if it was over $250,000 to send the notice individually, they could do it through media. That is what Equifax has chosen to do for this breach. They might be sending individual notice to consumers whose credit card information was breached, which was about 250,000 consumers, so a smaller subset of the entire breach. And we did receive a notification that's up on our website. There's a duty under Oregon law, and we are a little bit unique here, which is great, a duty to maintain reasonable security for personal information. Personal information is defined as your Social Security number, your financial account numbers, and a number of other things. Two facts I can share at this point that are public. The vulnerability was known, as was pointed out earlier, back in March. Basically, the hackers got in through a window that was open, that they left open, is the best analogy I can give. And also, ironically enough, the head of their information security at Equifax was a music major. Unfortunately, no technical background. So again, we are looking into that. We're asking questions, and we're doing what we can there. So finally, security freezes. As I mentioned, Oregon is $10 to freeze and unfreeze unless you're a proven victim of identity theft. This means you have to have evidence that, and DCBS will get into this, but evidence that your information has been used to open up a credit card account or a loan in your name that you didn't actually do, that kind of thing. Most states are in the $5 range, $3, $5, or $10. About seven or eight states are free. They make sure that it's free for consumers. So that's the breach in a nutshell, and happy to answer any questions.
Would you say the sites again, annualcredit.com or .gov?
Yeah, it is. Just want to make sure I get that right. Annualcreditreport.com. And then the 1-800 number is up there. That's also going to be on our scam alert that I'll get to you.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead.
Questions?
Why don't we take DCBS?
Thank you. And we do have a presentation to give, so I don't know if we want to rearrange chairs here momentarily. That would be. Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. My name is T.K. Keene. I'm Deputy Administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation at DCBS. Brian Fordham, who is our Consumer Advocacy Manager, is also with me here today to give some flavor to the kind of consumer complaints we have received. So I'm going to go ahead and just build upon what Oregon DOJ just shared, which I thought was tremendous, and so no need to plow ground that's already been plowed for me. Under the Oregon ID Theft Protection Act, which is at ORS Chapter 646A, the director of DCBS has a number of authorities that would come into play in a large-scale data breach situation. And so given the basic facts that are available in the media, we believe not wanting to, similar to DOJ, we do have an open investigation, so I'm limited in what I can say. But under that act, we do have the ability through the director to issue orders to cease and desist, some ability to remedy consumer harms through that have been occurred through a breach, and also issue civil penalties in the amount of $1,000 per occurrence, all the way up to a limit of $500,000. And that would be in addition to whatever additional penalties would be imposed by, you know, federal organizations or organizations such as the National Attorneys General or any of those sorts of authorities. So again, we are working with our Oregon DOJ partners and our federal partners to run to ground any violations of the Oregon laws. I'd like to dive in now to a point of consumer confusion, and something that we've been seeing is what are the differences between a credit freeze, a credit lock, and a fraud alert on an account? And I think the big point here is that the credit freeze portion that you all put into place is found at statute and offers a different and heightened level of protection than these other items that you see here, which are the credit lock and the fraud alert. The credit freeze completely blocks a consumer's credit record from inquiring creditors in situations where the consumer has opted to put that kind of protection on. The consumer needs to take steps such as signing up for a freeze, pay the $10 fee, and do it with each of the three major credit bureaus, which are Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, in order to put that kind of freeze and that level of protection in place. And I'll get to some of the fee issues in a future slide. The lock portion, it provides a bit more consumer flexibility. In that situation, the bureau, the credit bureau does allow consumers to be notified when a creditor is making an inquiry into their credit and then decide yes or no as to whether or not the creditor can access the file. The downside to that is that that is not found at statute in Oregon law, and any provisions around terms and conditions or fees that would be associated with doing that are a contractual relationship between the consumer and the credit bureau. Similarly, the fraud alert, which places a 90-day notification in the consumer's credit file, It allows the protection that allowed there is that it allows creditors to see that a consumer may have an ID theft issue going. The downside to that, again, is that it is for a period of 90 days. It's not an Oregon statute, and it is a contractual relationship between the consumer and the Bureau.
So the kind of information, though, in this data breach is not the kind of information that times out, right? I mean, so if somebody has my Social Security number, unless I go change it 10 years from now, it's the same information. So 90 days or a year worth of credit monitoring or freezing or fraud alert or anything else doesn't really matter 5 years from now because the information is the same, my address, my name, my driver's license number, my Social Security number. So all of these things are great, but it's not like you can stop doing them in 90 days or in a year with Equifax's, you know, year of coverage. That's helpful for a little bit, but it doesn't solve any sort of problem.
Sure. So, right? Chairs and Representative Williamson, the freeze itself does stay in place until the consumer removes it. So as I understand it, it's not time limited in any way. But to your point, you're absolutely right.
Unless you want to then go and buy a car or something and then you have
absolutely.
To unfreeze it and refreeze. I mean, it's
absolutely
right.
Yep.
But this kind of information, I guess I just say that to make a point. This is not the kind of information when you're talking to a constituent where they can take care of themselves for 6 months or a year and then the problem solves itself. This breach is not going to solve itself.
Chairs and Representative Williamson, absolutely correct, and that is consistent with the advice that we have been giving consumers, that they need to take additional proactive steps, such as a freeze, such as a lock, depending on what their situation is, to protect themselves, and it is going to be for the long haul. This is not, as you say, not a problem that goes away in 90 days.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on, a lot of consumer questions these days about, okay, so I want a freeze, so how long does it take to get that in place? And so by statute, if a consumer requests a freeze, it's 5 days, 5 business days. Should they request a freeze, then there is an additional 10-day period that the credit bureau has to notify them that the freeze has been put in place by in a formal writing, and should the consumers decide at some point to lift the freeze upon request, the bureaus have three business days to lift the freeze for the consumers. A lot of questions about fees, and so as has been mentioned before, it's $10 to freeze your credit account with these bureaus. It's $10 per bureau, so you're looking at $30 out of pocket right out of the gate. As DOJ mentioned, that $10 has been waived with respect to Equifax. It has not been waived with respect to the other two bureaus at this time. Additionally, should you decide to remove the freeze, you would have another $10 worth of charges for three bureaus to undo that. And should you decide to reinitiate the freeze, you would pay an additional $10 to put the freeze back on.
And I'm not familiar with this, so if I want to lift, undo the credit freeze after all three, I can't do just one?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. So there are certain circumstances when consumers need not pay, and they're pretty limited and usually involve the filing of a formal police report or being of a certain age. And so at this point in time, it would appear that consumers would not be eligible for those fees being waived by statute.
Mr. Chair, so victims, this isn't personal information or considered personal information theft?
Chairs and Representative Williamson, it is considered, based on what I know, and I don't want to speak too into the investigation aspects, but based on what I know, bare bones facts, it likely would be. The question really becomes then, do you request that consumers file formal reports with law enforcement, and given the number of people that would be impacted by that and the strain that would occur to law enforcement, I think we want to be in lockstep with the Department of Justice and also with our law enforcement partners before advising that consumers begin to do that. So that's still something on the horizon that could occur, and we also could be looking at a situation where we would be requesting, as our Attorney General is, retroactive fees or some arrangement alternatively that would be made for consumers so that they could get a freeze and get that paid for at all three bureaus. But at this point, I think that's a great point you make. I think we just want to be cautious about the implications of that going forward.
Okay, fair enough.
I apologize. There's an additional question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Just so I don't assume wrong things, with these freezes, if an account is put on freeze, that I just want to make sure that would not limit the improving of a credit score. Like it doesn't limit the information being sent to the agency, and you know, for your future credit score in 5 years when you lift a freeze and try to buy a car. Is that correct?
Chairs and Representative Stark, yes, that is absolutely correct. Your current credit record, as I understand it, under a freeze continues to build, and so there would be no impact to putting a freeze on your account. I think that also raises an additional issue, which is existing accounts. You know, a freeze is not necessarily going to help you should an existing account somehow be compromised, right? So the freeze would be in place to protect new lines of credit from being opened by nefarious actors. But should something be compromised with your current account, a freeze is not going to be able to assist you. But yes, you're correct. The credit score does continue to build.
So finally, we get asked.
We get asked quite often about credit freezes and lifting those. And so, what does that actually look like in terms of mechanics, and how does that occur? So should a consumer wish to have their freeze lifted, typically what happens is the credit bureau sends them a PIN number. They are asked to go to a website and put the PIN number and input personal information that would again verify that it is the true individual asking for that freeze to be lifted, and then the freeze would be lifted under the terms of the statute, which is 3 business days. And so just going to walk through really quickly for the record and for consumers who may be watching this or other members of the legislature, how you can get in touch with these bureaus and what the basic landing spot looks like for each of these bureaus. So here is the information for Equifax. It has been part of our presentation that we have submitted to OLIS, so no need to write this information down. Again, that's what the website looks like for Equifax. Here is Experian, and the landing spot for Experian, TransUnion, and again the landing spot for TransUnion. So at this point, I will turn it over to Brian Fordham, who again is our consumer advocacy and education manager, who's going to be able to share some color about the kind of complaints we've received and some of the trends here.
And just so we fill those out and send in our credit card number, the people who lost our credit card.
Can I say no comment, Chair Barker?
Yeah, yes, you can. Hey, I should have had no comment. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker and Brzezinski, again, my name is Brian Fordham. I'm the section manager of the Advocacy and Outreach Unit. Currently, we've taken not nearly as many calls as our counterparts, the Department of Justice. I can share that with you. The primary questions that we are receiving is, how do I go about getting the freeze on my account. And exactly what does that mean? And so much of our presentations already address that. Some of the things that we've done additionally at the department is, this is our website, and at the very front of our carousel, you can see we've added two additional tabs. One is a link to the DOJ press release, and the other tab is really goes into detail about how to go about putting the freeze onto the credit profile. I really want to reiterate that for consumers, the first step is obtaining the credit freeze as allowed under the Act. We believe that the federal and state agencies involved, along with the number of class action suits that are currently being prepared, will likely result in remedying individual harms. We're doing everything that we can to partner with DOJ so that should a consumer contact our agency, they have no need to contact DOJ. We'll take their complaint and forward it on to them. And that's really, really kind of concludes my comments. There's TK has already done a really good job of demonstrating the type of conversations that we've been having. Are there any questions?
Thanks, I'm sorry, Senator Prozanski.
Thank you. So, just kind of lay some framework. Chair Barker and I wanted this presentation because we want to try to get us out as much information as we can to constituents. I was able to be part of the drafting and passing of the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act in 2007. So I'm glad we have it in place, but now it seems like now it's been 10 years, maybe we will need to come back and look at some changes, such as the price for putting on the freeze. And I guess for those who are here, I was hoping that you were going to have packets for us, but it seems like maybe we're in the 10 years have gone away from having packets that we could provide to our constituents or that information, and everything's now online.
Well, we actually, Senator Prozanski, we actually do have a credit identity theft information brochure that we have uploaded into OLIS. We have that available in printed form as also in an electronic form as well.
So I'm just take a real quick guess here. Do members want to have printed, hand-printed stuff, or is it electronically good enough for your offices to get word to your constituents?
I think copies of that brochure would be handy.
I would strongly ask that you deliver that to all 90 members so we can make certain that we have stuff at our fingertips, and if you don't have access to a computer at that moment, they can maybe walk them through that. Mm-hmm. The cost of the freeze we've gone through, so we'll want to work over that. Another thing I've heard, and tell me if this would be inaccurate, knowing that pre-existing accounts such as credit cards, are you advising individuals to maybe go to the vendor that or where the credit card is and having a new card issued to them to get a new account, so whatever's on record now could be captured in the freeze for the new number?
So, Chair Prozanski, we are not getting to that granular level of detail as far as our recommendation goes at this time. I know a number of the individual creditors have made the decision to issue reissue credit cards. I can speak from personal experience. I've had three new cards issued from one creditor in the last year. Additionally, we've heard of creditors taking additional protection steps. So items such as where they would normally put a freeze on a consumer's account for unusual purchase activity. As we understand it, consumers are now seeing that those kind of limits lowered. So, where they used to easily be able to put through a $2,000 transaction, now they're getting calls at $500, $700, $1,000. And so at this point, our advice is really focused on getting people signed up for the credit freeze or a credit lock or some sort of proactive level of protection. And should a consumer feel concerned that their credit card has been compromised, then certainly they should get a hold of their issuer. And I have not heard of any problems when consumers have made that request. Issuers have been, in my experience, had no issues with putting a new card out in the mail.
All right. And two other points, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to put out there. We've talked about what the cost is and what I think everyone needs to understand. It's per person. So if you have a husband-wife partnership, whatever it is, each individual has to put the freeze on. You can't put a freeze on for your family type of thing. It's each individual. So those fees can add up. The last thing was that the response that you gave to Chair Barker about limiting access to a particular vendor to have access. I thought when we worked on this back in 2007 that there was a process that you could limit and only need to unfreeze one of the three institutions to allow a particular vendor that you're trying to do business with to be able to go through a specific one that they may use, where you wouldn't have to unfreeze all three mm-hmm. and then refreeze all three. Am I wrong on that?
Senator Przanski, I think that's correct. I think I'd have to go look at the statute, and I'm certainly happy to get back to you on that. I would say, though, that in many instances, a consumer may not know which of the three bureaus that the creditor will go check, and so that can cause some alignment issues. I would also add that from the creditor's point of view, sometimes because they contract out and have that kind of activity done by a third party, it's somewhat random to them, and so they may not know precisely which of the three credit bureaus the consumer's file will be checked against. So I'm happy to do some follow-up with you on that point.
And the last question is regarding those who have a freeze. I also believe that we set up where an individual could have a limited opening for, understand they have to do it within 3 days, but like a 48-hour open window to allow that creditor to actually go in and get that information, and it would be refrozen probably with the additional fee to reclose it, but having a durational, so it isn't like open it up, oh yeah, don't forget that I need to close it after a week or two or whatever.
That Senator Przanski, that's absolutely correct. So you can set a freeze for a fixed amount of time, or you can set or a thaw, as it's called, so unfreezing your credit report. You can decide to unfreeze it for a specific period of time, or it can be an indefinite opening. So, but to your point, you also then have to pay a fee to reestablish the freeze should you choose to do that.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure how to formulate this question, but let me try. I'm sure there are people that are pretty expert on understanding the whole motion of identity theft and how it works. This is an identity theft of 150 million people. That's a lot of people. I don't care about the effect on all those other people, but I do care as a citizen the effect on me. And I wonder if there's some way of getting a sense of probabilities of how likely it is for one of those 150 million people to be affected. I can't imagine a criminal conspiracy that could attack 150 million people at the same time. I mean, if there's somebody like that, we want them to help the state data system. They're not. Is there anybody that's actually made any sort of assessments of the likelihood of damage to individuals in that 150 million?
So, Chairs and Representative Greenlick, you know, I have not, and this is just strictly from news media, I have not got an understanding of who obtained the information at this point in time. And so without that information and understanding what their motives might or could be, there are likely people who could put a risk assessment on that sort of thing and give you a dollar value or a probability of how it could affect people or whether or not they will be affected, but absent additional information, and I know that's what our law enforcement partners are trying to track down right now, I don't know.
It seems to me that sort of information is important. If I have a 1 in 100,000 probability of being affected, I'm not going to get too excited about it. If I have a 1 in 3 probability of being affected, I'm not sure how to make that analysis because I'm a researcher, but that's not my field. But somebody, I believe, is thinking about that kind of question.
And one detail I would add to that is, as Representative Williamson said, this is not this problem has a long tail, right? So that's another downside to probably doing a detailed risk assessment. But it's conceivable.
Can I make one more comment?
Yes, you can.
Is there something we can do to limit the liability of people that have been attacked for identity theft? I mean, I know it's always been something on our mind, but this may have received astronomical proportion. And we need to look at if somebody gets into my credit card and charges $100,000, to it, I have to borrow money from the chair in order to pay it. Seriously, is there?
Now, we've already put that in. I mean, if someone is actually a victim of theft crime, you basically get to go through the police report and file it, and then that's going to give you the basis to be challenging any cost that they're saying that you're obligated for. And that's one of the reasons in that work group that we had back in actually 2006, we put the freeze in because we thought that would give more options to individuals besides what was being packaged by the three institutions, the credit bureaus, that you could actually have more control by freezing it. But if you're a young family trying to establish your credit and buying a lot of stuff, it may not be worth putting that freeze on because it, on and off, where other people who are more stable in their current life and don't need to be buying a lot of stuff that's going to be high-end type of stuff, you know, that's an easier way to do it. But I think the liability part, correct me if I'm wrong, as long as it's shown that you are a victim of theft, you're not going to be held accountable for those charges.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, it might be useful for us as well. We're briefing our 90 members on the freeze business that we refresh them on how our citizens are protected against the specific. I think that would be very helpful to have.
Chair Przanski, you are correct on that, and so I'm happy to delve further into that at a future session if you'd like, as far as what or maybe there's probably law enforcement who may be more appropriate to include in the conversation.
Maybe another way to do this to get to all members electronically, you can send us kind of a summary of what the presentation is. Not that they can't get it themselves, but I think again for us who are trying to make certain whoever's helping us get word out to constituents, if we have like a one pager and then putting some of these other key points on there, that way we can ensure that we give our constituents the best information and hopefully take a lot of that angst out that people are panicking and feeling right now.
While it'd be limited liability on my credit card if somebody got that number and used it, but I think probably a bigger picture, if I'm not mistaken, is that somebody starts opening accounts in my name, they can really foul up my credit throughout it, and then people don't know which is real and which isn't, and so and that's the real real problem.
That's it.
Okay. Representative Vial, did you have a question? Oh, okay. Anybody else? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Very helpful, indeed. Okay, next we'll open a review of the Title IX in campus sexual assault. Again, Aaron Knott and Jackie Sandemeyer. Please.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice. Here in a totally different tone this time, we pass a lot of legislation out of this committee. It's a very busy committee. And every once in a while, we're fortunate enough to start getting a sense of how legislation that we've passed in previous years is playing out on the ground, getting a sense of how practitioner behavior is changing, and in some instances, even the extent to which our model is being copied by other states. Campus sexual assault has been, in my estimation, a real bright point for the state of Oregon in the last few years in terms of legislative activity. Many of the members still on the Judiciary Committee were signatories on House Bill 3476, which made a tremendous expansion to the protections that a victim of sexual assault could expect in terms of their confidentiality. With me to my right is Jackie Sandemeyer from the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, and she's going to provide an overview of how some of our legislation has played out in practical terms. Before that happens, though, I do want to make one forward-facing remark. We live in a time of incredible change, both state, both locally and federally in this area. About a week and a half ago, the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, announced that the federal government is planning to embark on a series of reforms to the administrative rulemaking and other guidance around Title IX. Title IX governs sexual assault investigations to a significant but not an exhaustive degree by requiring our colleges and universities to engage in certain minimal thresholds of investigation and procedure when they become aware of a campus sexual assault. And much of the infrastructure that's built up around Title IX is administrative. It's not an act of Congress. It's been issued by the Department of Education either formally or informally as guidance over time. As such, it can be modified relatively quickly. The reason I highlight that now is if those modifications are coming, there is a very good chance that they will intersect with multiple levels of Oregon state law, civil, administrative, and criminal. The Department of Justice is absolutely committed to hosting the big table that has led to some of this past legislation that you're going to hear about. It's all been bipartisan and it's all been thoughtfully done, and we have that expectation going forward. So as the changing federal climate moves forward, we look forward to coming back to you with recommendations, and we just want you to know that we are engaged in this work. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jackie Sandmeyer.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Sandmeyer. I'm the campus coordinator for the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. Through my position as the campus coordinator, I provide technical assistance and training to all public, private, four-year, and two-year community colleges here in the state of Oregon. For reference, that's around, you know, approximately 55-plus institutions here in the state. And a lot of that technical assistance is around those nuances that Aaron mentioned around Title IX and then the intersection of Oregon state law, because Oregon, in a lot of many positive ways, has sort of widened the net of Title IX and the provisions and protections that we offer our students here. Really, Title IX over the years we've identified has three main goals, and one of those is to ensure some sort of rights and forms of relief and remedy for students who've experienced violence. And we often use the term sexual assault, but just for reference, that also includes domestic violence, stalking, and dating violence as well. Secondary, Title IX has created an alternative and additional avenue for victims. So previously, when they only had the civil or criminal process to rely upon, we've now added an additional process for students to seek, you know, another form of relief, another form of remedy, and most importantly, another form of justice for them. And then finally, most of all, if you actually were to ever read the statutory language of Title IX, you'll see that it really just talks about access to education. And so most importantly, what the task force in partnership with DOJ most puts in the forefront is a shared goal that I think all Oregonians have of students accessing their education in a way that's free of violence. And if students do experience some form of violence, that we can offer them services to get them to that graduation marker. Here in the state of Oregon, we see prevalence rates that are similar on a national level, which means the moment that a student steps onto a campus, they have a 1 in 5 chance just within those 4 years of their collegiate career of experiencing rape on that campus. So that means this is a very paramount conversation here in the state, because we've created a space that we want students to engage in, but they have now a 1 in 5 chance of experiencing a pretty violent form of sexual assault just within the time that it takes them to finish their 4-year degree. Oregon has been considered now in the last couple years the national best practice model for the country as far as an approach to Title IX, and more specifically response to campus sexual assault and the prevention of it. And a lot of that has had to do with the different legislation that we've been able to pass here in the state. One piece that has put us above other states in this is the fact that we had created the first and only campus program that was designed to provide technical assistance around these very nuanced federal laws, what that looks like in practice, sort of gauge what students are experiencing, and then come up with best practice guidance documents around how best to implement this. Since we've created that campus program in 2014, we now have 2 states who have formally adopted the model. That includes New York and South Carolina, who have created their own campus programs in relation to or in some conjunction with the Attorney General's Office or Department of Justice, and have adopted the campus coordinator position as well as some of the other elements of our program. To date, we now have 3 other states who are working with their Department of Justices to find funding to do the exact same model. Additionally, in 2014, we created the country's first online informational system for students to identify what their rights were, their options moving forward, including how to report to law enforcement if that were an option that they wanted to pursue. To date, we've served over 11,000 students through that website. And I checked the data this morning, and we now have students accessing it from 7 other states within the country. And we've had quite a few states reach out proactively asking for permission to adopt or mimic the same language on the website. When this legislature in 2015 passed House Bill 3476 that Aaron mentioned, creating advocate privilege, Oregon became the first state in the country to have confidential communication between direct service providers who were trained in working with students who'd experienced something traumatic in relation to Title IX, which really meant that Oregon, you know, was the first state in the country to be taking proactive steps around confidentiality. In this last legislative session, the state of Utah took House Bill 3476 and passed it almost verbatim and used a lot of the data that we've gleaned here in the state as commentary to why the bill needed to be passed. Here in Oregon, we've seen that since the passage of that bill, we've trained over 200 privileged advocates who are now employed by institutions of higher education. We've seen a 122% increase in Title IX reports since the implementation, and we've seen a 138% increase in students who are seeking services due to a sexual assault that they've encountered on campus. And you know, we've talked to national partners, and these numbers are considered unprecedented compared to the rest of the country that's trying to increase reporting rates. Finally, sort of on a training level, the state of Oregon created one of the first trauma-informed investigatory curriculums in the country, and this aligns with Title IX's requirement that all investigators who perform campus adjudicatory processes receive annual training around investigation. And since then, we've had both national organizations as well as 5 other states mimic our curriculum and ask the state of Oregon to employ some sort of assistance as they mimic the same model in their states. And then finally, the state of Oregon, through the Sexual Assault Task Force, was chosen by the Centers for Disease Control this year to create a resource and do sort of an in-depth analysis of how schools can conduct and implement and evaluate campus climate surveys, with the hopes that Oregon could help spearhead implementation around getting more data, more numbers on what sexual assault on campuses look like. All of these measures and different resources that we've been able to offer in the state are directly linked to different legislation that we've been able to pass here in Oregon that are really rooted in victim-centered, trauma-informed best practices. So again, you know, there's quite a bit of work to be done in Title IX, and I'd say that nothing's perfect, and we have our own challenges here in the state, but it really has been a privilege to travel nationally and throughout the state in my position and be able to say that I work in the state of Oregon, because I will say that it comes with it a very positive reputation in the arena of Title IX.
Thank you, Chair Parker, and thank you, Jackie and Aaron. I have been confused since I got this job why we were tying Title IX, which is an Equality in Education Act, I think 72 was when that was first adopted, and wasn't it renamed Patsy Mink in like 2002 and had some amendments, but it's really not sexual assault related, and why are we in Oregon talking about this as Title IX? And I think, Jackie, I made a note, you said Title IX reports were up. Are those discrimination in higher education reports, or are we calling these sexual assault reports Title IX reports?
So Title IX is part of a larger amendment that happened in the 70s of education amendments. So it also includes Title VI, anti-racial discriminatory, Title X, right. You know, accessibility, those types of things. But the actual statutory language of Title IX says that students should have access to education barring any type of gender-based discrimination. So right at the implementation, most institutions nationally had identified that as equitable athletic services, women's sports teams, but then also ensuring that women had access to higher education through a mixture of federal guidance, case law, claims being brought by individuals under Title IX, we've now identified that it includes sexual harassment. And similar to the civil arena, we depict sexual harassment to include sexual assault, rape, domestic violence, and stalking.
Follow up,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, so that gets to the real crux of my question. If it really was a essentially gender-based anti-discrimination law in the first place, does our anti-sexual harassment stuff really take a gender-specific line, or are we enforcing this sort of gender-blind?
Chairs, Rep. Wilt, any person of any gender can bring a Title IX complaint. So we've actually seen, since the implementation of confidential advocates here in the state of Oregon, we've had a historical increase in men coming forward who have experienced some type of rape. And again, we can have female students, male students. We have quite an increase since confidentiality around transgender students coming forward as well. So the protection that the law offers is in some ways gender blind. It just has to be some type of violence that arises out of a gender-based discriminatory act.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're getting a little short on time, but Senator Gelster, please.
Great, thank you. Two short questions, and thank you. It's easy to pass laws, but not so easy to implement them, and it's exciting to see the work that you're doing out there to make them work. One was, you listed off a lot of numbers. Can we get that in writing? I don't see it in OLIS, and that was exciting data that would be great to have. And then the second, would there be a way to extend some of that to kind of high schools and K-12? We're hearing more about the experience of high school students experiencing sexual assault, what that experience is like on a high school campus. Is there some sort of a corollary we should be looking at for high school students to be coming forward with challenges to their education because they're sitting in biology class next to the person that sexually assaulted them after the football game?
Chair, Senator Gelser, you bring up a great point. So a lot of individuals don't realize that Title IX is not just higher education, but it's also K-12, and then it extends the opposite way, so graduate programs, medical schools, law schools. The Oregon Department of Education has a Title IX coordinator who has provisions over the K-12 sector of it, where the task force is more adolescent, adult. But knowing that the task force works in conjunction with the Oregon Department of Education to make sure that we're making that bridge from K-12 to colleges the easier one, but all the same protections and rights apply. And then we haven't seen any of the state law that we've passed thus far that would discriminate between, you know, the rights or provisions that we're offering victims on campuses compared to what we'd offer K-12 folks in a negative way.
And then the data, can we get that?
Yeah, I'm happy to put that down in writing.
Thank you. Representative Greenan, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to follow on a little bit about what Senator Gelser was getting to. You cite a 1 in 5 probability of a college student being sexually assaulted during that 4-year period. Do you know whether that's significantly different than the probability of that same cohort of women, particularly who are not in college during that 4-year period? Is it? Because I suspect it's not hugely different. And if that's the case, we need to be thinking of ways to protect women or people in that same period in the community, not in college. It's a little harder process, I think.
Chairs, Representative Greenlick, in the state of Oregon, we know that 1 in 4 adult women, so that'd be 18 and older, will experience sexual assault in their lifetime. So over the span of their life, they have a 1 in 4 chance. What's unique about college campuses is that 1 in 4 exists just within 4 years. But I think you bring up a great point that the efforts we do in higher education need to be happening in conjunction with whatever protective measures we do in the community.
How do we get into the general community in the same way that we can surround a college with?
True. Senator Dimbrough?
Thank you. Thank you for the information, for all the work that you're doing. Are you monitoring, reviewing the ongoing discussions in the Department of Education around what campuses can or cannot do with respect to people who've been charged with sexual violence? I know there's an ongoing conversation around that.
Chairs, Senator Dembrow. So schools have options on how to sanction students if they're found responsible under a Title IX violation. And really, that only extends to their status as a student. So a school can only suspend, maybe have the student take some sort of educational class around sexual violence or expel the student. But they can't impede in any other avenue of that student's life that doesn't relate to their status as a student with that institution.
Sorry, Senator Lithicum.
Excuse me for asking. There must be qualifications to where this statistic is coming from. Every parent, every father, every mother in this room ought to never let their daughters go to college if after seeing a college population of 20,000 students, 5,000 of them are subject to rape. These numbers are just astronomical, and the 100,000 students that are in Oregon colleges, I can't believe that there's actually 25,000 rape victims that we can clearly identify. I would never let my daughter attend a school in Oregon if that's the statistic. This is insanity. So there's got to be some sort of qualifier with how these numbers are generated, what repeat offenses look like, what are the circumstances, because the numbers that you're projecting are just astronomical.
We could alternately not have the boys go and still let the girls go.
Well, yeah. Same deal, though. Let's pull all the men out of school, too, if that makes the place safer. This is really serious. If these numbers are accurate, this is really serious.
It is really serious, Senator. We'll ask them to, because we're running short time, we'll ask them to provide if you could provide those numbers for us.
And it's self-reporting, too.
Is that okay? It's
based on self-reporting.
Yeah, we're happy to follow up.
Okay, well, thank you. There's thank you very much, because we're running a little behind on the schedule. So thank you. And next is an update on justice reinvestment. Ross Caldwell, please.
But it is not strictly limited to rape. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairs Barker and Przanski. I'm Ross Caldwell from the Criminal Justice Commission, here to give an update on the Justice Reinvestment Grants Program. I appreciate we're low on time, so I'll try to be quick.
Thank you.
We're going to start with just kind of an introduction to the program. I think most of you have heard this several times, so just stop me if there's anything you want to focus on a little bit in more depth. So the Justice Reinvestment Program, just as a refresher, the four goals are to decrease prison use, reduce recidivism, as well as protecting the public and holding offenders accountable. And the model that we use for that is to invest locally in public safety systems, and then expect that those counties, those public safety systems, hold more people keep more people in the community as opposed to sending them to prison, and thus saving the state money, which is then in turn reinvested in the community. So it's kind of our cycle of life with our blue circles here. As I'm sure many of you are already aware, this has to be funded every biennium. In 2013 to 2015, after the original legislation was passed, it was funded at $15 million split up between all 36 counties. That was kind of a get-started fund. In the 15-17 biennium, it was funded at $38.7 million. And then in the last big session, it was funded at the same rate with the 2% inflationary increase. And then we also had $7 million in additional supplemental funding for downward departure prison diversion programs. So we are working on that grant as we speak. Just one more slide about funding. This is distributed to the counties by the Department of Corrections grant and aid formula. So every county has a slice of the pie they can apply for. That's not true for the supplemental grant. The supplemental grant is $7 million that does not have a formula. So that's a little bit different for us to administer, because we could, you know, possibly have one county apply for the whole thing, or one county could apply for $1 million or $2 million. It's not a set formula, so that's a little bit different process for us to administer grant-wise. The body that applies for the grant is the local public safety coordinating council. Each county has one. The members are provided in statute. And then 10% goes to community-based crime victim services, and 3% is reserved for for studying programs. And counties can either keep that and do their own study, or they can remit that to the Criminal Justice Commission, and we'll either do our study or we'll contract with someone to do a study. So this is a new thing that we have on our website. We get a lot of questions about where the grant funding is going. So where does that $38.7 million in the biennium that we just finished, where did that all go? So we created kind of a sort of a double way to look at this. As you can see on here, you can click on a specific type of service. The example we've picked here is housing, and it'll show you all the different counties that are spending money on housing. And then alternatively, you can click on an individual county. Klamath is our example here, and it'll kind of work backwards and show you what Klamath is spending all their money on. So kind of two different ways. If you're interested in seeing who's spending money on mental health diversion or something like that, you can look at that. Or if you want to zero in on a certain county in your district and see what they're using the money on money for, you can look at it that way. So that's on our dashboards on our website. And then the big question, how is this working overall? So we have come up with various ways to measure justice reinvestment. We get great data from the Department of Corrections, and we can see who's going to prison, how long they're going for, what crime type they're going for, all that kind of thing. And we track that very, very carefully. We're trying to make this as much of a data-driven grant as possible. So this is an example of a page from our online data dashboards, and we've got several more. And one thing that we're doing new this biennium is when counties are filling out their justice reinvestment applications, we're asking them to look at the data. So as opposed to us just watching them, we want them to look at the data and see how they're doing and see what they've decided to spend the money on in the past and make sure that it's actually working to achieve the goals that they're spending the money for. So we have kind of another dashboard for people online that counties can click on their county and they can look at their prison usage for justice reinvestment, which is typically the property, drug, and driving offenders. They can also look at their recidivism rates and the triple definition that we have in Oregon, so new arrest, new conviction, and new incarceration. And they can also look at UCR uniform crime reports. So we tried to get data that corresponds to all four goals of the program as best we can. So what are your prison use rates? What does your recidivism look like? And keeping in mind that it takes a few years to get good recidivism data, so you're not going to get immediate recidivism results for the people that go through your program. But also, you know, what is crime looking like in your county? And to try to make this responsive to the data. So one of the great things about the Justice Reinvestment Grant programs is that counties have a lot of flexibility to spend the money on what they want to spend it on as long as it's within the parameters of the goals. So we want to make sure that they are looking at the data and trying to figure out what works in their county. So what works in Multnomah County is very different than what works in Malheur County. So we want counties to have the flexibility to keep people locally, spend less of the state's money on prison, but also figure out how they do that and kind of find that sweet spot of offenders that they can supervise locally and still keep their community safe. All right, prison forecasts, and you've all seen these probably several times, so we'll go through them quickly. This is our line when we would need a new prison in Junction City open. This is where we were going back in 2013, our green line. This was our April 2013 prison forecast. Black is where we've actually gone so far. And then orange is our current forecast. So this is from April of this year. We're going to have a new forecast coming out in just a couple of weeks. It's not finalized yet. And the big change in that forecast is going to be the impacts from 3078, so those sentencing changes. And it's not finalized yet, so we don't want to get into it too much. But preliminarily what we're seeing is that this orange line, our prison forecast, is going to kind of flatten out and actually slightly decrease a little bit on the male side. So I know that Michael Kennedy at DAS is still working on that, but that's what it's looking like so far. And then on the female side, again, this is the line where we would need to open a new facility that's already built. We would need to build a facility on the female side. It's OSP minimum, and it exists, but it hasn't been opened yet. So this is where we were going back in 2013 is our green line. Black is where we've actually gone so far. And then our projection, which does stay above the capacity for OSP minimum, is the orange line. And then I think the new forecast is going to show a more dramatic decrease from those sentencing changes in 3078. So those sentencing changes from 3078, they do take a while to phase in. The sentencing changes, shorter sentences, it takes a while to actually for those people to go to prison on their sentence and then actually get out earlier. So it phases in slowly. The changes to short-term transitional leave, that's at the end of people's sentence as well, so that will phase in slowly. But as you can see from both the male and the female forecasts, we've got a lot of space in between the black line and the green line. We haven't had to build a new prison in Junction City, so overall this has been a very successful program. And then One of the other things we do besides our online dashboards to get counties the data is we have RIC meetings. So we divided the state into these four different sections. We go out and we hold these meetings quarterly, and we show them how the data is working and just answer questions, talk about application process, just kind of try to keep an ear to the ground and see what counties are hearing and what's been successful. And one of the other big parts of this is we like to try to steal ideas from counties that are having success with this and cross-pollinate with other counties. You know, we hear somebody who's doing a really good job on some kind of monitoring in a rural county with ankle bracelets or something like that, and we try to let other people know about that so they can do the same thing. And there's been a lot of success with that. A lot of counties have been copying each other's ideas, and I think a lot of good things are coming of it. And then for the 2017-19 grant timelines, so the Justice Reinvestment applications were due on the 31st, so we're working through those now. The supplemental grant applications for that $7 million, those are due on the 29th, so at the end of this month. And then we're going to have our victims 10% review panel meet at the end of this month as well. And then we have our grant review committee and our commissioners are going to meet to go over all the applications. And they're going to go over both the justice reinvestment and the supplemental grant applications at the same time so they can kind of see how those tie together. They have shared goals, and these are all something that are, you know, kind of meant to augment public safety systems. So we want our committee and our commissioners to be able to see how both of those will interact together. And then we should be able to get all our funds out to the counties with the contracts by the end of the year. So as soon as we get those contracts out, get them signed, we can get the money to them. So this is a very tight timeline for us, and especially with having this additional grant, it puts some pressure on us to get this done quickly, and it puts some pressure on our people to review these quickly. It's a lot to read. It also puts a lot of pressure on the counties to get these applications, and now that there's two of them, if you're going for the supplemental grant, it's kind of a scramble. But we are trying to get the counties money as quickly as we can so that they don't have a gap in funding and have to lay off people, you know, parole and probation officers or things like that, because that obviously causes problems for programs. I think I have one more. Okay, I guess I don't have one more slide. Any questions?
Maybe questions for Representative Vile.
So I'm excited that the lines seem to be going the right direction, but what I didn't see in that last black line versus the orange-green line slide, if you could go back to that one.
Was that the male side or the female
that,
side?
It's
just female here.
Yeah, go back to the male one. Go one slide further now. Come back this way. Advance one slide.
Okay.
Advance, yeah.
So this is the female population.
Now advance the next slide. So I was thinking of the female.
Okay.
What was there a projection? In other words, was there an orange line when we instituted the program? And how has the black line related to what would have been our orange line is my question.
I know that we had prediction, or chairs and Representative Vile. I know that we had predictions around the sentencing changes from House Bill 3194 because there were some optional probation on some drug crimes that were presumptive prison before, and there were some shorter sentences for some of the property crimes and driving crimes. We had some predictions around those specific sentencing changes, but I don't know that we had a prediction around the actual grant impact because we weren't sure how much counties would be able to supervise people locally. And we didn't really see a huge savings from the actual sentencing changes. What we have seen savings from is the grant program, so people building up their public safety system and keeping people locally as opposed to sending them to prison, and then short-term transitional leave being expanded from 30 days to 90 days. So those have been heavy savers for the state.
Follow-up? Thank you. So the reason I'm asking is, as I'm sure you're aware, the DAs are a little bit wound up about 3078. And
I've heard something about that, yeah.
The prediction that we're actually going to see significant increases in incarceration rates eventually because of those reductions in sentencing, particularly with respect to certain drug crimes. I'm really anxious that when we start talking about whether this is working or not, whether something like 3078 is working or not, that we use good data, that we look at, did we really predict correctly, and do we have true blind studies? Because you mentioned something that troubles me just a little bit. We're contracting with folks to review the data. Now, if those folks give us the answers we want, we'll probably renew their contract. If they give us an answer we don't like, they're maybe off the list. And so how are we making sure that we're getting data that is blind, that is peer-reviewed, that doesn't have a bias attached to it?
Yeah, excuse me. Chairs and Representative Vile, so the people that we contracted, and I went through that very quickly, but those are for the 3% studies. So 3% of each county's funds the county can either do their own study. Multnomah County is the only one that's doing that currently. And in some of the counties, they get the minimum of $100,000. So 3% of that isn't really enough to do much of a study. And we are conducting a few studies ourselves, and then we've contracted with some people. And those are around specific things like mentors. So they don't really study the whole program entirely. And it would be a little difficult to study the whole program because of the flexibility, every county can kind of do their own thing. And so everybody's doing something that's slightly different. And so it would be hard to study the program as a whole because all 36 counties are kind of doing different things. So the actual prison use, that's all us studying that. So we get the numbers from the Department of Corrections. We get that updated every month. And we're very confident in those numbers. And we can tell, you know, if, for instance, a certain county started sentencing very differently for drug crimes, we could tell that right away with about a month lag. So right away is kind of a loose term, but we could tell that within a month. And we do track kind of every month. The way that we track this actually is if you have a sentence in your county, we count you as spending that entire sentence within a month. So say you sentence someone to 25 months in September of 2017. That all goes on your books in September of 2017. So that allows us to really closely track when things are changing in counties. And then we follow up with them, and part of our job is to have a good relationship with the county so that we can actually go in and talk to them or go and talk to people in their associations and try to find out why things are changing. So, you know, I think anytime things get shaken up, like 3078, things get up in the air a little bit, but that's something we're definitely going to be keeping an eye on.
It's a long-term question, though.
It is.
It's not really. If we're going to really respond to the concerns of the DAs, we've got to look at this over as long a term as possible with really verifiable data.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm saying. This really wasn't a question, and I apologize for that,
Mr. Okay.
Chair. But I want to express my hope that we're going to do that.
And we do have some district attorneys that are very, very big proponents of this. This really only works. The slide that is missing in here that I thought was in here is about what we've seen work successfully in this program. And what we've seen be most successful is when counties really have relationships with each other and they actually trust each other. And, you know, the judges and the district attorneys trust parole and probation to do their job and to supervise these people. And, you know, you have to have a functional jail in order to make that happen. And there's a lot of things that we've kind of learned in the two biennia that this has been around. And so we have some, you know, we have a lot of counties that are bright spots that are really doing good work. But I think it is a culture change, so it takes a while to kind of phase in. But we do watch the prison use very carefully.
And I don't want to overstate the concern that the DA, in fact, you look at like Clackamas County and DA like Foote is really encouraging us to look at different ways to reduce recidivism and, mm-hmm. and reduce populations. But I do think that 3078 change in drug-related sentencing is something we've got to pay very close attention to if we're going to be able to support continued change like that for our population management.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to something that you were talking about before. You were showing UCR data. Mm-hmm. To give people an idea of what's going on in the community.
Yeah.
I know that some entities now use NIBRS. And so is that a combination of UCR and NIBRS, which is National Incident Based Reporting System?
Yeah. So where we have it, chairs and Representative Corsing, where we have that, it's a combination. And we do have some blank spots as people are moving to NIBRS.
Right.
And One of the big questions in our justice reinvestment application is, and something that we put in the snapshot for every county to look at, is what is your reporting rate? So what percentage of your agencies in your county are reporting? And in some counties, there's only one or two agencies, but mm-hmm. in some, there's a whole bunch. So we're asking them to look into that and, you know, not necessarily apply some pressure, but just to be aware that this is a way we can track data. And we don't really have a lot of great front-end data. So we can measure prison use, kind of what comes out the back end of the system, but it's hard to measure what's happening front end. Mm-hmm. And reported crime is kind of the best we have right now. And so we want to really encourage counties to make sure that they're transitioning and that they're getting those reported to OSP so that we can get that data.
Okay. A quick follow-up. What about National Crime Victimization Survey data? Do you use that?
Yeah, and we're actually working on our own victimization survey that will be specific to Oregon.
Oh.
So Dr. Ann Lehman, who's one of our researchers, is working on that, and they have kind of gone through a lot of different possibilities of what the shape of it could be and what the scope of it could be, and there's everything from, I think, different ways that you get into different communities, because we want to make sure that it's representative.
Right.
So she's been working on that for several months now, and we've reached out to a lot of stakeholders to kind of get input from everybody all across the spectrum and make sure people are aware of it. So we want to have our own and not just rely on the national the national thing, but we try to take that into account.
Thank you.
Yeah, but the upfront stuff is difficult. It's kind of a blind spot, unfortunately, in our data.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski?
Thank you, Chair Barker. I just wanted to do a call out. A bunch of students have joined us, and for those who saw them all come in, they're from the Benn International School. And this is, for many of them, their very first time to be at the Capitol. I understand they've just completed the tour. Hope you had a great tour. And I understand you're going to be spending a couple of days up at Silver Falls and having kind of a retreat. So we welcome you here, and we're glad that you had time to stop in our hearing and get to see how our state government works. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The update on the Governor's Reentry Council, Ms. Peters, please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Przanski and Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Colette Peters. I'm the director of the Department of Corrections and also have the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Governor's Reentry Council. So thank you for inviting me here today to share information on the work of that council, which serves to really effectively transition individuals more effectively from prison to the community, really focuses on changing the lives of about 5,000 individuals who actually leave our prisons and juvenile correctional facilities every year, and work to improve the lives of the family members who are there to welcome those men and women back home, certainly improve the likelihood that they will remain crime-free, and of course ensure that no new victims are created when they return back to our communities. I'll start with a brief overview of the council. The Governor's Reentry Council was first established by executive order back in 2007. It was Governor Kulongoski and then Director Williams at the time who were reviewing our primary benchmark, which was recidivism. And they recognized that over the years, we had really put the onus only on the Oregon Department of Corrections to reduce recidivism. And the reality is that research suggests that while in-prison programming and treatment is very important, it's what happened in the community that was the sure all in terms of recidivism reduction. So Governor Kulongoski knew it was going to take the assistance of both of your chambers and a cross-section of state agency leadership, social service providers, stakeholders, and more to really affect that recidivism factor. I'm just going to briefly go back in time so you can see the work that the council has done from the beginning. We initially had four work groups that each focused on a different aspect of reentry: employment, housing, continuity of care, reentry, transition service. Our work group participants were broad. They included former offenders and their families, employers, landlords, medical professionals and healthcare experts, public and nonprofit social service providers, corrections and law enforcement, and of course the other state agencies, as we mentioned earlier. From 2008 to 2013, these four work groups really did accomplish a lot, and I would like to share some of their successes to give you an idea of what the council had accomplished during that time period. The housing work group created a template for the standards that should be including in every transitional housing model and developed ideas around landlord incentives to encourage private market landlords to really consider accepting applications of these individuals who had a record on a case-by-case basis. to help combat the stigma around hiring individuals with a felony background. The employment work group actually conducted an employer satisfaction, or excuse me, an employer perception survey, which yielded almost 500 respondents, and the findings actually included that 83% of those that responded said they would be willing to hire someone with a conviction history if the crime was not related to the position they were applying for. So that was actually an incredibly optimistic statistic for us. 49% were open to participating in a program in which applicants were pre-screened, and that pre-screening aspect was really the top incentive for an employer participating in a program. We then used this data to develop processes for educating employers on benefits and opportunities for employing persons with criminal histories. The continuity of health and mental health care, we recognize that one of the greatest barriers to reentry is the ability to receive medical and mental health care. It especially was during this time period before the Affordable Care Act. So the continuity of care work group recommended to DOC a lot of process improvement, assuring that all persons leaving prison had a 30-day supply of medication, because often that's when we were finding that relapse would happen. And we worked really closely with the Oregon Health Authority to ensure that all eligible adults in custody were enrolled for health coverage prior to release. Now, prior to the Affordable Care Act, what that meant, if you were a woman with a child, you were likely eligible. The rest of those leaving prison were not. So the Affordable Care Act really has been quite the benefit to those in the criminal justice system. And I'll talk about that data here in just a little bit. The Reentry and Transition Work Group recommended improving services to incarcerated veterans through partnerships with state and federal Veterans Administration. So we began to confirm veteran status. That was something we hadn't done before. We looked at eligibility for VA health care and other reentry services upon release, and connection to county-based veteran services officers for case management and assistance with adjudication of veterans' benefits. Now, I'd like to do a special call-out to Director Cameron Smith, who's been an absolute visionary about this work and an incredible partner, and we'll talk more about his recent efforts here in a minute. A couple other improvements that happened in the 2008-2013 time period is that representatives from the Mental Health Directors Association, the Community Corrections Directors Association, and the Department of Corrections developed and actually signed a protocol for the transition of people with mental illness from prison to the community. And that MOU has been continuously updated when needed each biennium since 2009. In prison, we installed kiosks in our prisons where adults in custody can access reentry websites, sites like the Employment Department, the Department of Human Services, Transitional Housing, ODVA, etc. We also began offering a transition curriculum called our Road to Success. It's a program that individuals can receive 6 months before leaving prison. Of course, the classes are voluntary, but individuals assessed as high or moderate risk to reoffend are given highest priority to enter the program. Training topics include employment skills, financial management, housing, success on community supervision, those family relationships that we know are so important, and wellness and self-care. Through our Burn JAG funds, grant funds, we received $1.5 million that were invested in three multi-service sites during that time period to create one-stop transition service centers serving justice-involved individuals. More grants. The other accomplishment I would like to highlight is the Second Chance Act grant. In partnership with the council and these four counties that are mentioned here, DOC applied for and received a 2010 Second Chance Act grant to fund transitional housing and wraparound support services for post-release of 200 high to medium risk offenders who would otherwise have been homeless upon release. And as you can imagine, homelessness is an incredible barrier to successful reentry. So that also was a great outcome. So that's a brief history of the council. And now I'd like to turn your attention to just the last 3 years, where we've really rolled up our sleeves. Many of you are familiar with the work we've done internal to the Department of Corrections to become an outcome-based organization. We did the same thing with the council. We really wanted to begin to have measures that we could track, targets that we established to really become an outcome-based council, so we could actually show you all the good work that the council was engaged in. So we created implementation teams and developed targets, which we measure quarterly. These teams have strong community involvement and focus on a specific concern of reentry. There are seven, and they are the aging population, which in prison, that is my fastest growing population. It includes the business community, education, family and community connections and engagement, juvenile reentry, sex offender leveling system, and veterans, which I mentioned previously. Aging populations. The aging populations implementation team is led by DHS's Aging and People with Disabilities Director, Ashley Carson Cottingham. The CARE conference team is responsible for ensuring the following issues are addressed for the inmate cases presented. And these are the adults in custody who are releasing who have very complex medical and mental health issues upon release. So they look at eligibility. They propose staffing needs and requirements post-release. They notice appropriate staff and organizations who might be able to help this individual. They look at timing and scheduling of medical appointments post-release. So that's all that's coordinated before they even leave one of our prisons. They spend a lot of time educating the adult in custody on what the transition and release will look like. They figure out transportation from prison to the facility in which they'll be staying. They establish primary health care plans. And why all of this may seem like an obvious step to all of you, those are things that weren't happening before. So that's a huge step in progress in a systematic way. It was happening on a case-by-case basis, but this really created systems in place to make sure that we were being consistent. I would like to really compliment and thank Director Carson Cottingham on the record, who not only was the visionary around the table, but she's also the one who would personally pick up her phone call on a Christmas Eve, by example, to personally manage a very complex case. And that's a real live example. It really was on Christmas Eve. So a big thank you to her and her continued work. I'm thrilled with the work of the business community implementation team. It was originally led by Dick Withnell, who is now retired from the council, and former state representative and current Marion County Commissioner Kevin Cameron is co-leading this with John Viev Martin of Dave's Killer Bread. This team connects businesses to the reentry population for employment opportunities and engages and educates business communities on reentry issues. The plan that they presented just this week to the council for the next year is very exciting. One of the team's big successes involves enhancing the use of the work opportunity tax credit for employers and really educating employers on that tax credit. So through the work of this team and the Oregon Employment Department that's been an incredible partner around this table, they were able to increase the number of certifications for persons convicted of a felony who started work in 2016 to over 1,000 certifications were awarded. That totaled $2.6 million in tax credits to local businesses, which
federal tax credits.
Yes, which is incredibly substantial. Now, if we stay on target for 2017 and the first 6 months look like the last 6 months, those numbers will also continue and will total about $2 million, just over $2 million. Now, in this next year, the team is going to host regional workshops. So they're actually going to get into every region across the state and meet with chambers of commerce, workforce development boards, government agencies, community organizations, and co-host to look at employer and employee perspectives, community impact, really debunking myths about what it means to hire someone with a record, and connecting talent to jobs, also talking about local employer incentives if they were to hire someone. Now, as a note, they are also planning a summit kickoff in January, of which all of you will receive an invitation. It will be hosted in Salem, but they promised me this is not a Salem or Marion County-centric event. It is going to be a statewide kickoff. So I'm very much looking forward to those results as well. The education team developed 6 recommendations. I'm going to highlight 3 of those that are incredibly substantial. They would like to create for pre-release adults in custody that they should have effective access to high school and post-secondary certificates or degrees as they're leaving prison. They want to establish a system of credentialed, stackable, and universally transferable education that is available at all corrections facilities and that ties pre-release and post-release education into a pathway that leads to completion of something beyond a high school diploma. They want to incorporate educational planning as a critical component of pre- and post-release AIC planning. Right now, we simply receive general funds to ensure that everyone receives a GED equivalent, a high school equivalent, or a GED. And so this really is stepping it up fairly strongly, of which I'm a huge proponent of education. The data is very clear. The higher your level of education, the lower your recidivism rate. So if we are actually able to implement these goals, I expect great outcomes. The Family and Community Connections Engagement Lead team is co-led by DHS and DOC. The team initiated phase 2 of the implementation team. This included recruiting new membership for this team. And I'm not going to spend much time on this implementation team right now, as this has a very new future, thanks to Senator Dembro's vision. And so we will talk about that in the final slide around the changes that this team will embark upon. The juvenile reentry team. This is led, or has been led, by the former Oregon Youth Authority Director Fairbors Paksuresht. It'll be now led by Interim Director Joe O'Leary and Deborah Martin from OIA. These deliverables include that DOC youth transitioning from an OIA youth correctional facility will have the residential level of treatment services post-release that they need, so matching the need with the service. Also develop a model of transition services for transition into the community. Create a practice where sex offender treatment completed in an OIA facility is recognized in the community. They have an incredible 7-stage sex offender treatment program that's evidence-based inside, and yet now many of the youth are having to start over when they get to the community with community-based sex offender treatment. So we want something that's more effective and more streamlined. Also develop a really strong model for information sharing between OIA, DOC, and community corrections that supports that seamless transfer of information between transition planning and case planning. Our sex offenders and leveling system is another one of our implementation teams. That was sponsored by Parole Board Chair Michael Wu. Its primary objective was to implement the legislation that you passed in 2013, which was House Bill 2549. That was the product of a 2-year legislative work group. It created a 3-level system for ranking sex offenders based on their risk of committing another sex crime, as established by a designated risk assessment tool. With the changes to sex offender registration in this bill, the group is really guided by the importance of providing information to many sectors of the public, and a lot of their work was just really educating the public on what this meant and how people would register. Veterans. Back to veterans. As this work was part of our history, it is also a strong part of today's council work because, unfortunately, we have far too many incarcerated veterans in Oregon and across this country. As I mentioned, it's led with great passion and great vision by ODVA Director Cameron Smith. This group has achieved many deliverables, all focusing on developing processes to work with the adults in custody to confirm their status, actually confirm that they're veterans, confirm that they're eligible, and that their families are eligible while they're incarcerated, and work to provide those family members benefits while their family member is incarcerated, and then work to improve transition and release with benefits immediately following release. And their work included all of the recommendations from the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force. And I'd love to go through all of those recommendations this afternoon, but in the interest of time, I will just let you know that that task force report and recommendations can be found online. Now, moving forward, as I mentioned earlier, really big thanks to Senator Dembro's vision and the research concerning the children of incarcerated parents. The council will work to align all of those efforts of Senate Bill 241 with the council's work. Senate Bill 241 very clearly directs the Department of Corrections, in cooperation with the Governor's Reentry Council, to develop guidelines for using the Bill of Rights of Children of Incarcerated Parents in policy and procedure decisions that impact incarcerated individuals with children. We know that if we can break the intergenerational cycle of incarceration, that our expanded work will be greatly impacted. We also know that individuals who are children of those parents who are incarcerated have a much greater likelihood of coming to prison. So it's a highly at-risk group of individuals. The governor is clearly committed to this vision of Senator Dembro's and rewriting the current Governor's Reentry Council executive order to reflect these changes and reflect that vision. And so we're really looking forward to working on that. It's clearly a work in progress. I'm sorry because I was ill last week. I had to miss the council meeting, but our work will continue in between meetings, and I'm looking forward to that. With that, that ends my formal presentation. This work has been ongoing since 2007, and so I would like to publicly thank the longstanding members of that council. Many of them were beginning members, and they still stand and still attend regularly and are active members. I'd like to thank the implementation teams who are really doing the work. They're really rolling up their sleeves and actually making the work happen. And I would like to take the opportunity to thank my staff who have been staffing these efforts all along. And they've all worked tirelessly to make these results happen. So with that, I will end my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Director, thank you so much. You had mentioned about the reclassification efforts that we put forward. I think it's a good thing. However, I think that there are some unforeseen side effects that was caused by that. For example, I have a constituent who was convicted of a sex crime over 30 years ago. He was released from prison back in 1984-85. He's been living in the community with no other offenses or anything like that. Since we implemented this, he just received a letter classifying him as a level 3. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? Are we retroacting this new law? Because he's not offended or anything like that, so now he's being reclassified as a level 3. How do we justify that?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Manning, I would be happy to take a look at the individual case. If you could forward that to me, I'd be happy to review it with the parole board to see if he was a existing registered sex offender or not. So I'd like to look at the individual case. You're not alone. We've had lots of constituents come forward very afraid of what this will mean for their employment, what this will mean for their success in the community, and confusion around what it means to be level three. Is level three bad or is level one bad? And all the questions in between. And so if you want to forward that to me, Senator, I'd be happy to take a look at it.
Yeah, I would like to talk to someone about that because, you know, I have known this constituent for at least last few years, what he's been dealing with. And I agree. I mean, there's no sympathy or anything like that. But I think that, you know, when you are, you register, if you're doing everything that you're supposed to over 20 years, and then all of a sudden you receive a letter saying that you are now classified as a level three, you have to do this, and kind of diminish what we're trying to say by acting appropriate in the community, and then are we intending on making that retroactive? And then if so, how far back do we go? So I would really like to talk with you about
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
I think I need to put something on the record there. Senator Manning, I've talked about this. There's a lot of other things we need to look at on this, and I think doing a one-on-one is probably the best way to do it. Okay. It's quite possible, based on what the parole board, when we were looking at this, if they had someone that was non-compliant, not saying he was, but if non-compliant in registration, they were pushing them into a level three to get action. In other words, you're going to be up live on screen if you don't take that. So,
could have been that.
And Director Peters, thank you for looking at that, because it's a concern, because if everyone is doing what they're supposed to do, we don't want to continue to penalize people that have moved forward in life.
Agreed. Thank you, Senator.
So before we close, the one thing I do want to put on the record for the Senate, I do appreciate that the governor, in her wisdom, chose to veto Senate Bill 689. That was the one that was going to set up a task force, which would be a legislative task force, dealing with reentry issues. It's my decision as the chair of the Senate committee that we are going to move forward with the work group. I think it's important that we have the understanding that the council is a representative of the executive branch and helping the governor to do what she is charged to do. We, on the other hand, being the legislative branch, I believe need to have our somewhat independence. I expect that both are going to connect in some means in some way. But for us to be looking at policy independent from what the executive branch might be suggesting. And please, Director Peters, understand that we want whatever input comes from the council regarding modifications and policy, any amendments and bills that we may need to do for statutes. But at the same time, I hope that that the governor's office understands and that you and others on the council are not alarmed by the legislature taking on an independent look at this to ensure that the policies we have in place are the ones we think are best at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'll share your sentiments with the governor's office.
Can I add to that? Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for those comments, Senator. And Colette, thank you very much for linking me to the bill about the values for incarcerated, the children of incarcerated parents, the Bill of Rights, which I'm really proud of. But I will say that was the work of the task force on reentry, and the work group that the senator's talking about will continue that work. We ended up passing, I think, four or five bills on reentry, almost all of them unanimously, which shows that this is something this body is really serious about. I'm proud to sit on the Governor's Reentry Council, and I certainly will provide a lot of liaison between these two efforts. It's important that the legislature do its work, and then the admirable work of the Reentry Council in bringing all of the executive branch agencies together to make sure these brilliant ideas actually work. It's very important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay, and health evaluations conducted by DPSST.
DPSST.
Yeah, I am.
There he is.
Yeah.
you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Harris Gadlicks, I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety, more commonly known as DPSST. What we're going to do in just a few minutes is go through a couple of slides, and I think the title of our visit may be a little misleading because we're not running a healthcare organization for public safety, but we are doing some work that I think you'll find of interest, and that's why we're here today. Most of you know from our appearances, we spend a lot of time talking with you about law enforcement issues, corrections officer certification, et cetera, but really a large constituency group, and the largest constituent group within DPSST is private security. We license over 20,000 private security providers in the state of Oregon, which is our largest constituent base. So I'm joined today by Lindsay Hale, our Professional Standards Division Director, and she's going to go through kind of the changes that we've implemented and also some baseline information on the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. As Eric mentioned, my name is Lindsay Hale. I oversee the Professional Standards Division at DPSST. Part of those responsibilities do include oversight of the private security regulatory program. We also have Susie Herring here, who's the program manager of that program. So I did put together some slides just to create the awareness of what that program is. It is a very complex regulatory program. I know that it's been a very long afternoon, and I don't want to just throw more data at you, so I'm going to burn through these relatively quickly with the hopes that you'll ask any questions that might pop up. So as Eric's mentioned, the Private Security Providers Act was established by the legislature in 1995. The intent was to improve the competence of the private security providers in Oregon through DPSST's Governing Board on Public Safety Standards and Training's establishment of the minimum physical, emotional, intellectual, and moral fitness standards. Those are the same authorities the board has to develop standards for law enforcement transferred to private security. As you can see by this slide, the private security services encompass a wide swath of job functions, from your traditional loss prevention officer employed by a retailer to individuals working as bouncers at bars or nightclubs, or individuals providing canines to guard premises or detect drugs or things of that nature. Our private security constituency does average around 20,000 individuals, so by far DPSST's largest constituent base. Here you'll see the breakdown of the types of private security providers. We have unarmed, armed, alarm monitors. We also have managers and instructors. I've included in this slide the number in parentheses of the individuals who are currently employed in each of these capacities, or I'm sorry, certified or licensed in each of these capacities. Some individuals hold multiple certifications. The minimum standards for certification and licensure varies slightly by discipline. Providers of unarmed and supervisory managers are required to be at least 18 years of age. Armed providers, instructors, and executive managers must be at least 21 years of age. Education for all is at least a high school diploma or GED or equivalent. There's a big or missing in the slide, and I apologize for that. You do not have to have your two-year or four-year degree. It's you have your high school GED or equivalent or a two-year or four-year degree. We have come across some very rare situations where an individual completed their primary education and didn't result in a traditional high school diploma, but were able to continue through post-secondary. We would recognize that as satisfying the education requirement. The training also varies by discipline. Unarmed professionals are required to complete a 14-hour basic course that covers DPSST rules and regulation and also the Oregon laws that are applicable to private security, for example, the Citizen Arrest Authority and things of that nature. Armed professionals are required to complete the 14-hour basic unarmed course, and they're also required to complete the 24-hour armed course, which includes a safe gun handling test and a marksmanship qualification. The specific courses required to become a manager and instructor, each must also complete the 14-hour basic course, and then they have a specific course, be it a manager or an instructor. If you're an armed firearms instructor, you're required to complete that 24-hour basic armed course as well. All private security providers must meet and maintain good moral fitness as determined by administrative rule. Moral fitness is determined by a criminal background investigation or a DPSST investigation that would be initiated as part of a complaint received by another provider, a citizen, or an employer. The board has adopted core values for the private security industry, and they include honesty, good character, public trust, fair treatment of others, and respect for the laws of the state or nation. A violation of the core values would be the inverse of these, for example, dishonesty or a lack of good character, et cetera, all defined more specifically in administrative rule. Finally, and I think this is what links directly to the invitation for this presentation this afternoon, there are emotional standards for armed private security providers. No armed private security professional or instructor may have been found mentally ill or otherwise be prohibited from carrying a firearm by a court of law. It's important to point out that these are federal preclusions from firearms possession. The determinations have to come from a court of law. This isn't something that DPSST traditionally has made or has the authority to make, or the board has the authority to make. Effective June 23rd of 2017, DPSST can require a medical evaluation if information is received from any public agency indicating that an individual is a serious risk to the public health and safety. This standard currently exists as a temporary rule. We are engaged actively in the permanent rulemaking process. It's actually being presented to the board for approval to file it permanently at their meeting in October. So, Eric, I'll hand it back over to you.
So as we look at what are the current issues that we're working on, I know you're going to probably want to come back and ask questions on some of these, but we're looking at establishing the emotional standards for pre-certification and maintenance for armed providers, as Lindsay covered. We really look at this with little oversight over the companies employing private security providers. We really license the people that do the work, and that there's a lot of discussion that we have regarding misuse, misunderstanding, and misrepresentation of authority, and we've got a few pictures here to show you what triggers most of our complaints. So these are some pictures around the states. You will see that the graphics are misleading. The uniforms could be misleading, and a lot of people call us saying that these men and women that do this work look like law enforcement officers. We have no oversight over how they look or how they wear a uniform or what the graphics on their car shows. This is one from Mount Bachelor that the Deschutes County Sheriff sent us, and it's two private security employees up there that wear body armor that says agent. This is very misleading to the public because they don't know who these people are. So this is an issue that staff is working on, and it may require legislative action. But out of the complaints that we get, other than complaints that we get from one business against another, most of the citizen complaints are about this exact issue. It's how the cars look. It's how the officers look. It's how they appear. It gets down sometimes to if the light bars have blue and red lights, which of course is a police vehicle, to the officers' uniforms look like police officers. And we honestly don't regulate any of that. But we are spending a lot of time in issues soon. We're trying to figure out how to solve it because this is not going away in our complaint process. So that, Mr. Chair, is a quick overview. We know it's the end of the day, but we'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
I have a question. So regarding this last issue of maybe misidentification, giving the impression one's a law enforcement officer, are any other states taking action to regulate that in any way, do you know?
Chair Prezansky, Senator Dembro, it varies state by state. We know that some states actually very specifically in statute identify what a private security officer can look like and what they can't. For example, one state has that they can only wear a square badge. They can't wear a badge that looks like a police officer. The graphics, for example, on their vehicles are regulated. The color of uniform in some states, I believe Minnesota, regulates what color the uniforms can be for private security providers versus law enforcement officers. So state by state, there's different levels of oversight, and we're really trying to figure out where we should be because we know that there's a cost to the companies to provide these services and employ these people to their uniforms and their cars. But in some cases, as you see, even the font sizes match the Oregon State Police cars. So either it's deliberate or it's creative marketing, but the concern that we run into is from the consumer, the layperson on the street that sees one of these people. We believe that they should know they're a private security provider and not a police officer.
So, how will you decide whether or not to recommend that we take some action on this?
We're having a lot of discussion within our staff and also within our private security committee. So we're all working on this, and I think it's important that I share that 99% of the private security companies do a really good job and they provide a really good service. So we're not here to disparage any company. What we're looking at really is so we address the mental health issue that Lindsay shared, but now the discussion is what do they look like and how do we help tailor that so that people don't believe believe that they're a police officer and that they're there to provide a higher level service than they really are, because a private security provider has no more authority than any of us sitting in this room. It's a citizen that's carrying a weapon, that's wearing a uniform, that has no police powers whatsoever.
And Representative Gorsuch had
just one quick thing. So, Eric, we did have that law that we passed about not being able to use certain law enforcement terms in their title. Has that had any beneficial effect that you know of?
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, we did get the administrative rule passed implementing that and what it would look like on our side from the regulatory perspective. And to my knowledge, and I'm going to look towards Susie, I don't believe we've had any issues.
Okay.
So what that does is really just regulate what new businesses can call their
right.
companies.
Right.
So we do have a system to monitor it. We have not had any issues pop up yet.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So, this, I think, one other thing. We've kind of looked at this before in some of these areas. One of the concerns we've had is, like, the surplus vehicles that are being sold from law enforcement. I mean, I can see where you have the still have the front grill, you have the white side lights, and someone's going to pull over, and we're seeing this happen. So I'm glad that we're still looking at this. We had the same thing with the uniform issues. I'll use the University of Oregon in their perspective of how they dressed their officers before they were officers. And we had EPD thinking they had an officer on one end of the building when it turned out it wasn't. They did not know the protocol, and that puts everyone at risk.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, Eric, thank you all both for looking at this, and we do welcome your input, because we have to get on top of this, because I don't want our state to be another mark where someone's pulled over thinking they have legitimate law enforcement behind them, taking law enforcement agency actions and find out that are bad character.
Thank you.
I just heard of a case in Eugene where a fire car pulled somebody over, like for a police violation, which was the fire department's handling that complaint. But
good.
Well, thank you.
One more thing.
Thank you very much. One more thing. We have an overview of interim work groups.
All right. Chair Barker, Chair Przonski, members of the committee, we just wanted to give you an update on what your staff is doing and what's going on in the committee work and areas of interest that might be coming up for you. So I've divided these up. I'll go through them fairly quickly. Here are some joint House Judiciary and Senate Judiciary work groups that are getting underway or already started. Some of these have started. I'll try to indicate that. If so, some of them have not been formed yet. We're still working on getting it together. So, first off, we have guardianship. I'm handling that. We had several bills this last session dealing with guardianship and access to proposed protected persons. So if you have an interest in that, come talk to me. We have the task force on the testing of sexual assault forensic evidence kits. That is actually meeting Thursday at 3 in hearing room F. Josh will be handling that ongoing, so if you have an interest in that, talk to Josh. Custody and parenting time, this is a big one that's coming up. We had a couple of bills dealing with these issues. We will be taking a fairly holistic approach on this, looking at various models around the nation and seeing if any of them are appropriate for use in Oregon. So if you have an interest in that, please let me know. Digital hearsay is a one that's coming up in the Law Commission at some point in time. It should be a very large, long-term project, but it's a very interesting one. Civil Commitment Work Group. Josh and I will be working on that one, reviewing the civil commitment standards and opportunities for strengthening assisted outpatient treatment. As always, our favorite drones will be continuing through the interim. Representative Vi will be taking over the helm of that particular work group. Expect to see a bill in 18. Whitney will be taking on a work group on restraints of students based on some of the discussions that happened in the 2017 session. Josh will be taking on a modernization of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, so look for some information there. Additionally, Josh is working with Senator Taylor on a work group for U visas. Whitney is working on towers, again, another perennial topic, tow truck drivers and regulations. I see Rep. Sanchez would like to help on that one.
make that easy worse.
Whitney and Josh are holding a standing work group on criminal law procedure issues. And from what I've heard today, we're going to have a work group on an update to the Identity Theft Protection Act and a work group on reentry.
There we go.
Finally, a couple of Senate Judiciary-specific work groups that are underway. The Advanced Directive Work Group is continuing. Whitney will be handling a marijuana regulations work group, and additionally, a social gambling work group. That was a topic that did not come through Senate Judiciary or House Judiciary, but is one we'd like to take a look at. Any questions?
Sounds like you got a few of those. That should be Human Services.
Yeah.
Not that I'd point that out.
So I think that brings us to an end. So I think the Senate is going to go ahead and adjourn. I don't know what happens to the House unless we have a vice chair around.
Oh, very good.
Yes,
very good.
Right. He saved the day.
Very good.
Yes,
very good.
Right. He saved